and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Last month, the publication The Atlantic launched a list of the great American novels, an ambitious project that brings together the most consequential novels of the past 100 years, a period that began as literary modernism was cresting and includes all manner of literary possibility, including the experimentations of postmodernism and the narrative satisfactions of genre fiction. The 136 novels on the list include 45 debuts, 9 winners of the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, and 3 children's books. 12 were published before the introduction of the mass market paperback to America, and 24 after the release of the Kindle. At least 60 had been banned by schools or libraries. In an introduction to the list, The Atlantic's editors write that together, the books selected represent the best of what novels can do. Challenge us, delight us, pull us in, and then release us, a little smarter and a little more alive than we were before. You have to read them. Gal Beckerman, a senior editor at the magazine and an author himself, was integral to the project, and I caught up with him in New York recently. Gal, tell me about The Atlantic. What's the history?
So The Atlantic is, of course, a very old magazine, or old by American terms, let's say. It was started in the 1860s and has always had a strong sort of literary sensibility. It was started, in fact, by transcendentalists and was a home for people like Emerson and Thoreau to write. So that's always been in the DNA of The Atlantic. There's been moments where it's become more or less interested in politics, international affairs, and recently, you know, in the last few years, one of the efforts that the magazine is making is to return to that literary root that it has.
How has it evolved over the years?
Well, it has become, in some ways, it has sort of returned to its initial purpose, which was to sort of capture the American idea. And you can't see me, but I have that in air quotes. trying to tell big stories about how we live today and the way politics influences personal life in America. I think that the last few years in particular has been, the magazine has taken a sort of strong position in terms of defending democratic values. So it sees itself as a sort of a guardian of certain essential kind of American values. And it tells good stories. I mean, it's not just heady. It's also, we're really interested in good storytelling, in bringing different kinds of voices to our readers.
And of course, you are the home of great writing. Just being brought down here to speak to you, I came down your magnificent spiral staircase, and that has books by everybody who's ever contributed to the magazine.
It is. We have a very big staircase, and we're trying to collect books by many of the contributors from over the years.
Gal, what's your personal history?
So I edit the book section here, and I come from the New York Times Book Review. Just 2 years ago, I moved over to The Atlantic. I'm also a writer myself, though I don't write fiction, as our list that we'll talk about consists of, but I write nonfiction. I've written 2 books. And so I have had sort of a foot in both worlds as an editor and as a writer.
Tell me a little about your 2 works.
Of course, a pleasure. Well, the first was a history book that was published in 2010 called When They Come For Us, We'll Be Gone, which was a history of the movement to free Jews from the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And the most recent book, which came out just 2 years ago, is called The Quiet Before. And that was a book that explored the way that social movements develop, but in quieter ways, the way small groups of people sort of come together and the forms of communication they use to develop radical ideas. So it's went historically, you know, started in the 17th century France and went all the way to the Black Lives Matter movement in 2020.
How extraordinary and so relevant for today.
Yeah, no, it was one of those. It was a book that was instigated in some way by my own response to the way social media was being used and misused for the purpose of trying to make social change.
Now, we come on to what really has been, I don't want to call it your life's work, but certainly your concentration for the last few months, which is putting together this absolutely huge project. Tell us about it.
Well, life's work. I hope that I have many more things to contribute in my life. No, this was a very big effort to identify a new canon for America. You know, it does sound like a very ambitious thing to have tried to do when I put it like that. But we decided that it was a great moment to sort of look back historically and try to, you know, establish for ourselves and for our readers what are the books, the American novels in particular, worth sort of including in the list of books that will last, that will be read, you know, 100, 200 years from now. And this was a fun project because of the parameters we gave ourselves, I'd say, because we looked at the last 100 years. So we started in 1925 until today. And we did that because that 100 years is, to our minds, sort of a period of time in which the canon is still in flux. You know, if we'd put Moby Dick or Huckleberry Finn on there, you know, everyone would have said, well, how obvious, of course, you know, because those are, it's pretty settled. But 100 years is a time where things really sort of go in and out of fashion. Things that seemed 50 or 20 years ago to be, you know, the most interesting stylistic innovations in fiction now seem sort of, you know, not so interesting. So it seemed to us a good period of time, a good unit of time to look at. And the other thing that was beneficial to us was that this was American literature. And American literature is constantly sort of renewing itself because people are constantly coming to America and sort of using the novel to define and redefine what it means to be an American, using it as a form of expression. Both of those sets of parameters produced a lot of wonderful books for us to look at.
How would you define the great American novel?
Oh, God. Well, I mean, one thing that was clear to us once we looked at all the books, you know, that we were considering and the books that we landed on, you know, very few of them, there might be two of them that I could name off the top of my head, self-consciously set out to write the great American novel. Most of these are just great American novels. You know, they're just books that try to tell a particular story, a story that had voice, that was written in a kind of an engaging human way about the characters that the novelist was writing about. But it happened to be set in America, and it happened to come from an American sensibility, however that changed over time. And so I think the way we thought about it was the combination of all these books sort of tell us a great American story. But any one of them is particular, although has that wonderful quality that a good novel has of being sort of universal in its particularity.
When was this idea of the first great American novel first floated?
Actually, in 1868, as our introduction to our project states, there was this idea after the Civil War, you know, after this moment of sort of existential crisis for America, that somebody should set out to write sort of a novel that captured it all, that told the story of America. Of course, anybody who's ever written fiction or, you know, read a lot understands that if you start off with a too huge an idea like that, it's not going to really lead to like a great piece of art, right? So this has been sort of an intimidating concept, I would say, for novelists who have tried to sort of meet it. As I said, there's maybe like two books. I was thinking about this morning, actually. You know, there's two books I'd say on our list, maybe Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man and Saul Bellow's Adventures of Augie March, that I can sort of pinpoint as I bet that they were trying to write the great American novel. Interestingly, they were doing it. Both of those books came out in the early 1950s, sort of at a real pivot moment in 20th century American history, post-war America itself still in flux. But those books, you can tell that there is a kind of ambition to tell the whole story. But most of these books, they sometimes do capture very, very big ideas about America and its challenges and its conflicts. But they're getting to it through individuality, through trying to tell a small story.
Yeah. So you've given us your time constraints. Yeah. You decided what that was going to be. But what were the other metrics that helped you decide? And who else was on the panel? I mean, it must have been quite a large collective project.
Well, one of the first things that we decided, you know, is that we can't sit in a room. I certainly didn't want to just like sit in a room and come up with the great American novels. I, you know, I've read a bit, but I haven't read enough to have a full panoramic view. So the first thought was, let's go to the people who do have strong opinions on this. So we went to a collection of novelists and critics and academics who have particular knowledge about American literature and asked them each, for their five books. You know, their five books that they would thrust on anybody as like, these are the best of the best novels of the last 100 years. And we really went to a wide range of people. I mean, everyone from Henry Louis Gates Jr. to, you know, some wonderful contemporary novelists like Ruman Alam and Gary Steingart and Katie Kitamura. I could go on and on and on. But, you know, there was maybe about, you know, 4 or 5 dozen people, you know, that we implored to help us with this. And then we took all of their suggestions and sort of put it into a big pot, you know, and began a process of culling and sort of examining. And there were, I mean, there were a few different factors that we were sort of thinking about. I mean, the most important being this notion of, will this last? You know, is this a book that says something to us today that we can imagine it also speaking to people, you know, in 100 years from now, which is, of course, a speculative sort of exercise, but that was the brief that we gave ourselves. But, you know, composed in that is, you know, is does it have a certain literary quality, a literary quality that we find actually compelling and that still holds up? Because there were books that sort of spoke to their moment, but we read them now and the writing felt stilted, or it didn't sort of have the same power that we would want each of these books to have at a stylistic level. The other question we asked ourselves was, you know, was this a book that did something new in terms of the form, you know, of the novel? The last 100 years is full of wonderful experimentation. You know, I mean, that's the other thing about the period of time we picked, which is, you know, we begin with where modernism is sort of peaking, and then you get wonderful books, you know, that sort of delve into the world of like postmodernist styles, you know, experimenting with first person, with autofiction, you know, but you also have a lot of genre, what we would call genre fiction on there, you know, children's books and horror and science fiction and noir, and all that kind of explodes in the last 100 years. So we were looking for people who did interesting things with the novel. And also, you know, we wanted to get a representation. We wanted to sort of capture, you know, America as a country with so many different groups of people and identities, and they each people have used the novel in different ways to sort of try to express those identities. And so we really wanted that reflected too, you know. So it was important for us to, you know, we went to a novelist like Tommy Orange, who's a wonderful Native American, has Native American heritage novelist, and said, what are the books that you would pick? What are the five books you would pick? And he pointed us to some books that we then understood to be real masterpieces in sort of capturing that particular experience. And we wanted that all reflected in the list.
I wonder if there were any particular periods in American history. So, for instance, I don't know, the assassination of JFK or 9/11 or any other sort of seminal moments in the last 100 years that threw up some particularly interesting books.
It's a good question. I mean, in some ways, and it's funny because I've had this conversation about 9/11 and why it hasn't produced any like really great novels that we can point to, because I don't think that it quite has, and people will argue with me about that. But I think World War II and sort of the post-war period and the way that it scrambled American society in so many different ways. I mean, there's an interesting sort of feminist argument about what it did for women. There's a, you know, kind of racial dynamic of sort of how the war changed how we think about race in America. And all of that is sort of reflected in the novel. I think that, you know, you can see even a book, there's a wonderful noir novel by a writer named Dorothy Hughes that we put on here called In a Lonely Place. And we liked it because we wanted to reflect that great noir tradition that comes up in the 30s, 40s, 50s, but we wanted to get at it from a different angle. And what Dorothy Hughes did is she tells a story. It's basically a serial killer novel. Like you're following a killer throughout the book who's targeting women. And you can see underneath the story this sort of anxiety about the power that women, the small power that women had gained during the war. This is a book that came out in 1947. We're just coming into the post-war period. Women during the war have been empowered in very interesting ways, you know, had to fill jobs that men had. And there's a return to a society that is like in flux on some of these questions. And you see it reflected in this book, which is about a man who himself is a veteran and is out targeting women and clearly has a complex about them. And it's a woman writer, Dorothy Hughes, who's sort of trying to capture this dynamic.
I was very impressed by the amount of women novelists on the list. How does that actual split work? And just tell me about numbers, because you didn't settle on, oh, we're just going to get the top 100 or whatever. You came organically to a number that seemed to fit.
Right. We off the top of my head, I don't have the number breakdown in terms of women to men novelists, but we ended up with 136 books, which is funny because some of the reactions to this list have been incredible to read and to engage with. But one of them is, well, if it wasn't 100, if you didn't have a hard stop, like, why couldn't you have included my favorite writer? But we, you know, we realized from the beginning that we didn't want to commit ourselves to a round number, that we didn't say, you know, because most people would do this list and make it 100. We didn't really want to do that. So we just kind of took it to the place where it naturally stopped for us. You know, I think we did sort of want to cover each decade, you know, roughly with the same number of books, you know, make sure that we had enough that filled in the different moments in over the last 100 years. But we really just, you know, debated and took out books and put back books back in and argued with each other and got to this place where we said, yep, this is it. This is sort of where we want to, this is where it feels right.
Reading in context is really important. Mm. And I wonder how you dealt with writers whose work is now seen as problematic, but at the time it was written was something that was completely accepted.
It's a good question. And I think, you know, we debated this a lot. And there were certainly moments where we thought, this book just doesn't feel, it feels, it's not just that there's a problematic expression or a way of talking about groups of people or something, but it just feels stale. It doesn't feel like it's going to speak to us anymore. And so, you know, maybe those were books that we didn't pick so much. You know, we really tried to find novels where the themes really transcended their time also. And if there was too much of a kind of a distracting quality of prejudice, you know, then it got in the way of us feeling that the novel could do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A number of names appear several times. Maya Angelou is one of them. Joyce Carol Oates, of course, is fantastically prolific. Mm-hmm. How do you choose which works from a certain writer to put on? Yeah.
Joyce Carol Oates was particularly hard because she has, like, I don't know, 80 novels or something. Well, you know, in some cases, I think with her, we picked Blonde, which is her book about Marilyn Monroe. We picked the book that seem to resonate most with an audience. I mean, I say that, and then on the other hand, we had many moments where we swerved. We sort of zigged where everyone else zagged. You know, we said, everyone loves this particular James Baldwin novel. Let's go for the one that actually people don't know so well, but we think is that it might be better. So there was some of that too. But in Joyce Carol Oates particularly, we thought, you know, we need to, let's think about the one that seemed to stay most with people. And then there's writers. I think Toni Morrison might be the only writer who has who has three books on there. There's a few who might have two. Philip Roth, I can't think of a few others who might have two. But Toni Morrison was one where it was just too hard not to pick. And her work has been too influential and too beloved. Beloved. There you go. Not to give her a little bit more room on the list.
So America is traditionally seen as the home of movies, and storytelling here can be very, very visual. And in fact, that's how I think the rest of the world thinks about it. Given that context, does the novel really matter?
Oh, I think it does. What kind of question is that? I think the novel can do things that film, which I love too, cannot do. The novel can explore interiority in ways that visual medium can't. It can explore multiple perspectives of a story, you know, in a way that a film can't. And it has something that I feel like actually is subversive these days, which is the quality of slowing time down. You know, I have two daughters who are teenagers. It's so important for me that they read because everything else in their life moves so fast. And when they lose themselves in the space of a novel, we're talking about weeks, you know, where they're living with characters and with a story. And there is something that I think our brain is fed by that, by that experience of really staying with something for a long time. And you can, I mean, that's the beauty of a novel, is you can really sort of live in it for a period of time.
And so different from this time of TikTok and Instagram and all the rest of it and YouTube, how does the novel survive something like TikTok, which is fundamentally changing the way we concentrate and consume?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, I worry about it. I mean, I think this list is a little bit of a cri de coeur for us, for on our part, saying, like, look, this is really, these books really matter. Look at the sort of change and ideas, you know, they were able to reflect and then absorb about America. It's a medium that really matters and that we should care about. And I think the way it survives is it just does what it does well in a way that no other medium can. You know, TikTok will never be able to do what a novel can do. A movie won't ever be able to do what a novel can do. But novelists have to sort of remember that and stay true to... I feel like there are these moments where writers try to sort of take into account the limited attention span. And you can see a little bit of that in the novel. I mean, there's been novels recently that are sort of like broken up into these little chunks of text. And you can see it as a reflection of a novelist sort of understanding that this is how the brains of its readers or their readers are, work these days. And that's fine, you know, but I think that we need to sort of remember what a novel does well.
I mean, because some would argue that novels or reading is really just the province now of the, I don't know, of the global elite or the highly educated.
I mean, I don't think that's true. I think we actually, in some strange ways, we live in a more like textual society than ever. You know, think about the way we engage with our phones even, and the way we are online. You know, we're reading all the time in some ways. We're just not reading long sustained stories. I mean, the other thing I was in, this is me reassuring myself, is it's always been a small group of people who have been the sort of vanguard of, you know, caring about writing and this sort of art form at this level. You know, it's just that now we expect everything to be mass, you know, so it feels like, oh, it's dying because there's not the millions of people who go viral on after a TikTok video aren't reading a novel. But like, but those people were, I mean, there was never millions of people reading a novel to begin with. It's always been a relatively small part of society.
And of course, we're in this era of fake news, and that is essentially what a novel is. It's mis or disinformation. It's made up.
Yeah, but it's done so consciously. I mean, you know, it says novel on the cover. I mean, even the recent trend towards autofiction, you know, which is sort of really self-consciously taking the elements of your own life and turning them into a story, mostly in the first person. Even those are labeled as novels, you know, because people, there is an understanding that even though if you dug a little bit, you'd find a close correlation between the life of the writer and the life of the narrator of the book. There's enough deviation that let's think of it as a novel. So I think that's the difference. I mean, the problem with fake news is that it's purporting to be real news.
Yeah. I wonder, though, if it could be argued that creative nonfiction is the greatest American art form.
Well, you're talking to somebody who is a practitioner and who loves it himself. I don't think one has to choose. I think that there is certainly one. You could do a list like this of creative nonfiction or of nonfiction that has had a big impact on society and the world, even, you know. And maybe we'll do that list. But fiction does something special, which is it tells a story. I mean, creative nonfiction can as well, but it tells a story that emerges from the mind of the writer who has absorbed the society around them and wants to create characters who will live with us, you know, as readers. And that's a very special, different sort of thing. But I wouldn't want to have to be forced to choose.
Yeah. I wonder why, though, America makes that stark divide between fiction and nonfiction. Mm. Where, for instance, if you look at, I don't know, Latin America, that it's much more fluid. Yeah.
No, it's a good question. I mean, I first a little bit in European literature, too, and it's much less stark, the divide. I don't have a good answer as to why, other than that it's just, I think, embedded in us, in our national character somehow, to have this way of thinking about stories, you know, falling into a certain category. And then, you know, we want to know that the things we're reading that are true are really true. You know, I mean, people get very upset, for example, there's been scandals around situations like this, when a memoir that purports to be true is found out to be made up. There's a famous case of, it's now a number of years ago, by James Frey, A Million Little Pieces, where he told this story of being in jail and these terrible things happened to him. And then it turned out, you know, Oprah sort of, you know, lifted him up as one of her books. And then it turned out that most of it was made up, and people got quite angry. And it's interesting to try to understand that anger, because I think it gets to your question. I think people want to, I don't know if it's an American quality, but there is a desire somewhere. Maybe we're losing it in the age of fake news, but it's somewhere in our DNA is like this idea that the things that we'll read that are labeled as truth should have some truth to them, and it heightens their attraction to us because we know that they're true.
Yeah. Who's not on the list? I mean, there are many people obviously not on the list, but who are the notable people not there? And in terms of the reaction to the list, who have people been most upset about?
Well, it's interesting. I don't want to like go out and name too many people that are not on the list, but I will tell you that I can sort of capture some of the reaction. Why don't I do that? Because I think that, well, there was one name that people have brought up a few times, which is To Kill a Mockingbird, which for many people is a beloved book that they read in, you know, middle school. It's, I don't know if it's still being read, but it's, and you know, that's like a Harper Lee. We debated whether to put the book on the, because we wanted to have a certain number of books on this list that we would seem crazy not to have. You know, they just needed to be there because we would not be a legitimate list if, say, Invisible Man, for example, wasn't on there. But To Kill a Mockingbird, we sort of all went back to and said, you know, this was a really wonderful sort of morality tale. It turned into a great movie. But when you look at the book, like, do we feel that the literary quality of it sort of holds up? And we sort of came to the conclusion that maybe no. And of course it's going to be controversial. I mean, part of the fun of this list is throwing things out there like that that people are going to argue with. The other one that I've heard a lot the last few days is there's a clique of very impassioned postmodernists who are angry that we only have one Thomas Pynchon on the list, or that we don't have a writer like Bartholomew on the list. You know, that they're very upset about that. Yeah.
No Colleen Hoover.
I'm sorry. I mean, that I will. No comment.
She is, of course, the TikTok sensation. This is a very difficult question, but do you think you could name your top five?
Oh, God, on the spot, you're going to ask me this? I would really have to think about it. I mean, one book that comes to mind for me, I mean, definitely Invisible Man. I know I've mentioned Invisible Man a few times, but that is a book that's always meant a great deal to me. Sabbath Theater, which is Philip Roth's 1995 novel. I'm a big fan of his work in general, but that book, if I had to lift up one, that would definitely be one of them. There's a few books that I sort of discovered through this process that I find I'm just happy to have come across them, and now they've sort of entered my own pantheon. One of them is this remarkable book from 1937 called East Goes West by a Korean-American writer named Young Hil Kang. It turns out that he's sort of the first Korean-American writer, because at the time it wasn't a big immigrant group. And he wrote this very sort of picaresque book about an immigrant who arrives in America and sort of travels the country and becomes slowly disillusioned, you know, with everything he sees around it. But it's just a funny, just well-written, just engaging story. Oh, God, there's so many. I mean...
How can people access this list? Because I know that my listeners will want to sit and digest it and then probably order most of the books, because you do it beautifully. You can click through and read much more about each book.
Yes, and I really have to give a lot of credit to our design and art team, because they created a beautiful interface, a beautiful way of engaging with it. Well, you can come to theatlantic.com, and it should be pretty easy to find. If it's not on the homepage, we have a drop-down menu for books. And if you go there, you can see the list, and you can see all of our other books coverage.
Gal Beckerman, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks also to the producer, Tamsin Howard. And you can download this show and previous episodes from our website or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.